Hello and welcome to The Bulletin with UBS on Monocle 24. Each week we'll be hearing from the sharpest minds and freshest thinkers in the world of finance, taking you beyond the numbers and the hype and getting to the heart of the big issues of the day. This week we head to New York City for an extended edition of the programme. Let's start with a question for you. What happens when a brilliant MIT professor and a scintillating Formula One world champion sit down together to discuss the future of mobility and sustainable energy? Well, on the show this week, you can join them to find out as Nico Rosberg takes over the microphone to interview UBS global visionary Donald Sadoway. So let's turn over our presenter's chair to a man who's probably spent more time than most on the other side of the interview process, racing driver and UBS ambassador Nico Rosberg. Nico sitting down to chat with Don Sadoway, Professor of Materials Chemistry at MIT. Well, gentlemen, the floor over in New York City is yours. Perhaps you can both introduce, or perhaps that should more accurately be, reintroduce yourselves.
I'm Nico Rosberg. I was the 2016 Formula One World Champion, which was really like achieving a childhood dream for me. And now, moving on from that and really exploring the whole impact technology space, primarily as an investor, also as an entrepreneur. And so it's exciting times in this space because there's really a big momentum coming and quite a revolution happening at the moment. So it's really really fascinating.
I'm Donald Sadoway. I've been a professor at MIT for 40 years. My area is electrochemistry, and I've worked in two major fields. One is in electrometallurgy, how to make metal from dirt, using electrochemical processes, things like aluminum, magnesium, titanium, what have you. And starting about 1995, I branched out and began doing research in batteries, initially in batteries for mobile applications. I was inspired by automobiles. And then starting about 13 years ago, I started working on massive batteries for grid-level storage. And en route, taught big freshman general chemistry class, and those lectures went on the internet, and it's been a rich experience.
It's great to meet you, and welcome on the podcast. Very happy to have you here, and for me it's a cool experience to have someone of your level of competence, and usually I'm the guy being interviewed, and today I am interviewing, which is going to be great. So thank you very much in advance already.
Well, I'm honored to be here, and I've always valued experience that occurs when you step out of your comfort zone, and to be interviewed by a world-famous race car driver, that's out of my comfort zone, so I'm looking forward to the experience.
Okay, that puts both of us out of the comfort zone.
Yeah, good.
This can only be great. I also have a bit of an engineering mind because I really loved racing engineering, race car engineering, when I was driving. And it was a sort of edge that I had over my competitors because I really, really focused on that, trying to understand the dynamics, vehicle dynamics behind the car. Because when you're driving, it helps so much when you actually understand the whole physics behind what's happening. So when you then communicate with your engineers and you tell them, okay, I've got this and this problem, if you're already able to speak in their language and straight away jump into possible solutions, mechanical solutions, it just makes it so much easier, because you're then on the same level as them. And that was one of the competitive advantages that I had during my career. I even had a place at Imperial College to study aeronautics when I was 17, straight out of school, but didn't go because my whole racing career kicked off. I started winning everything, and it was a good decision in hindsight. I think it went quite okay. So first of all, I think the most interesting thing would be what first got you into this passion of working on batteries. I think that would be very interesting for all of us to hear.
It's an interesting story. Around 1994, 95, I was invited with, I think, three other professors to visit Ford in Dearborn, Michigan. And at the time, they were working on an all-electric vehicle. This was a Ford Escort that they had fitted with electric motor. And they were using sodium sulfur batteries that were built by ABB in Heidelberg, Germany. And why sodium sulfur? Because Ford actually invented the sodium sulfur battery in 1966 when gasoline was 20 cents a gallon. Nobody was dreaming about electric cars. During the visit, at one point, they threw the keys at us, and I was allowed to take this car, not on the test track, went out on the open road. they put a governor on it that we couldn't go faster than 72 miles an hour. But even so, I was just so excited at the prospect of all electric drive and the flat torque curve and the rapid acceleration. And I realized that the only reason we don't see those cars is that the battery is holding it back. Everything else was in place. And I got back to MIT, and the next morning I looked in the mirror and I said, "You're an electrochemist. Why don't you do something about this?" And that's what triggered my interest in batteries, that drive of the all-electric vehicle at Ford.
That's a great story, because at the moment out there, there's still a lot of reservations towards electric cars. Mm. But I think more and more people will actually see that they are awesome to drive and they have awesome characteristics, which are just great fun.
Yeah.
Yeah, of course, there's some downsides, like no more noise from the engine, which some people really love. But I think very soon everybody will be over that and will just love and embrace e-mobility because of all the things that you said. And recently I've been driving some of the top cars out there. Example, Tesla X in the ludicrous mode.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And it is fascinating. And mm-hmm. I have driven the world's fastest cars in my life. And this thing beats all of those. It even beats the acceleration of my Formula One car. Yeah. My Formula One car accelerates from 0 to 60 miles an hour in 2.6 seconds.
Right.
The Tesla ludicrous mode, 2.5 seconds. Recently, I also drove the Porsche Mission E, which is going to be one of the groundbreaking ones as well coming out. It's great fun. It really is. I even got an electric motorbike just now from Italy. It's called Energica. It's one of the leading ones out there. Racing bike. Yeah.
Yes.
It's not just a cruising motorbike. It's a full on racing bike.
Okay.
And fully electric, and great. But with that one, you can still see that the development is not quite there. Yeah. There's still commercially available batteries are still lagging a little bit in everything compared to a petrol engine, yeah? And on this bike, the battery makes the bike heavier, yeah? But it's a little bit everywhere. So it's a little bit on the weight, it's a little bit on the cost, it's a little bit on the range, and it's a little bit on the power. Can you take us through where you think the batteries are going to be going now in the short term? What's the next steps? And where you think that next generation of batteries is going to be in 10 years' time, possibly, if you manage to create the genius invention that you're currently working on, if you manage to make it happen, and therefore also if you are 100% convinced that electric drive is going to be our future.
Well, let's go back to the early part of the question. Where are we today? We're making full exploitation of the lithium ion chemistry. This came online around 1990-91. So it's been around for quite some time. It's been refined and refined. But to get back to your accurate concerns about range and power and so on, I think the future is to jump to a new chemistry. And that requires radical innovation. And there's plenty of room at the top.
And it requires Professor Sadoway as well.
Possibly. It does.
In all modesty.
Yeah, in all modesty. Yeah. I'm originally from Canada, so you put me in an uncomfortable position.
I'm sorry.
I
apologize.
No, the Canadians are the ones that are first to say I'm sorry. But anyways, so I think with new chemistry, you'll see a quantum leap in performance. And I'm convinced that the future is an electric future. And it's for exactly the reasons that you detailed earlier in your comments, the fun of driving. I mean, the fact that it's zero tailpipe emissions, that's of course important, and of course I'm fully on board for sustainability. If the choice is sustainability and a gloomy future where people are sad and they don't enjoy anything, or the alternative, it's really a tough choice. But this is a case where everything is aligned. The electric drive is superior, and it's also sustainable because you can generate electricity sustainably. You can't burn carbon sustainably. So I'm very optimistic about an all-electric future. And that goes beyond driving. And I believe industrial chemistry will change. All industrial chemistry will become industrial electrochemistry.
In terms of sustainability, the big question for us out there, for all of us, is today, is an electric car really a step towards sustainability compared to a petrol engine car, or not yet? Is it actually in a very similar place and it just opens a whole load of future possibilities for future improvements to then make giant leaps towards sustainability? So what I'm getting towards is, how unsustainable currently is the sourcing of the metals, the production of the actual battery itself, the eventual recycling of the battery. Maybe you can give us, in a nutshell, your view on that currently where we're at.
Well, let's not forget that the internal combustion engine has been around for over 100 years. It is the product of so many improvements, so much research. To compare that to a technology that is in its comparative infancy is at some level an unfair comparison. I foresee that the all-electric vehicle will continue to improve and will surpass what we see with internal combustion. And there's no question that from a sustainability standpoint, internal combustion engine just doesn't measure up. But now that the broader question about sourcing, metals, recycling, and so on, I mean, again, these are questions that are still unanswered because we're not in a lockdown position with respect to all of the technology. I mean, a lot of the bodies are being made out of fiberglass. The frames are going to be made out of steel. I suppose if you were really aggressive, you could make the frames out of aluminum. And we have sustainable ways to source and produce those metals. With respect to the lithium-ion battery, it's a little more problematic. As we know, that there's in the positive electrode, there's cobalt, and cobalt, 60% of that comes from Congo. There is a lot of reporting on the use of children in the mining of cobalt. They call it artisanal mining. It's a papering over the fact that children are gathering nuggets out of the river. So those things need closer scrutiny. But I think that what you're seeing now is people addressing that. I was at a conference here in New York a couple of months ago, and in which I learned of a company that was just formed in Toronto that is essentially cobalt blockchain. And they guaranteed the entire custody of the cobalt that goes into the battery. And they can take it right down to the nugget that was picked up and can certify that it was done in a way that isn't a violation of what we would call a proper humane treatment of people. I think you're going to see more. I mean, if you take a look at an airplane that crashes and it has to do with a failure of an engine, they have essentially blockchain custody of every part that went into that engine. And if it was a titanium part that failed, they know all of the siblings that came out of the same litter that made that titanium vein, and they can immediately notify every plane in the world that's flying those things. So we have the capacity to put custody on all of this stuff. So I'm optimistic.
How do you think we can achieve and speed up innovation in the Western world?
Well,
because if I can just touch at the moment, it's sort of badly needed, as we just touched on this one point, but it's badly needed in many different areas. What do you think some of the key things could be to give this a real big, badly needed push?
Well, I'm going to go out on a limb here, even though I'm not.
Limb is fine.
I'm not a.
The listeners, I think, would appreciate some limbs.
So I'm not an economist, political scientist, but I am an observer, and I believe that. Well, I wonder. Like, I shouldn't say I believe, but I wonder if we change the tax laws, so that we allowed private investment in. Risk-taking research that could result in breakthrough technologies, if we took those investments and gave them a tax credit that was on a par with, say, normal gift-giving for charitable purposes, I think we would see the unlocking of a huge amount of very patient capital from people who are motivated by the desire to make the world a better place. Who are not worried about fast turnaround and recovery with profit in 3 to 5 years. The other thing about that is that these people are free thinking, whereas right now there is a lot of government funding that goes into this area. But unfortunately for the government funding, there's peer review, and peer review typically involves people who are already in the industry. And I've learned that if you want to get an honest assessment about radical innovation, do not ask the incumbents, because the incumbents are threatened by disruption, and they will not say, this is really cool. If it works, it could be fantastic. They're going to just say, this is crazy. It hasn't been demonstrated at scale, and on and on and on. So I think this whole question of changing tax laws is something that has captured my attention.
So, dear Mr. President, please have a look at the tax laws for the technology sector for the greater good of us all in the longer term, and to give the West an opportunity to really stay on a level playing field with the Eastern countries and really push forward innovation, because innovation surely is going to have the best potential to evolve in the West currently for still some time, I suppose, right?
Yeah, I'm taking down your notes, and we're going to write that up and mail
we're
it off.
We're doing this together.
1600 we're both, Pennsylvania.
We're both
yeah.
signing yeah. off.
Signing off.
Very good. So yeah. chances are good, yeah?
Yeah.
So moving on, just maybe touching on artificial intelligence and how it's coming into the mobility space in a big, big way. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's not around the corner, but it will surely happen at some point. Bit of a concern. I mean, first of all, I'm a bit concerned because I love driving. Mm-hmm. So I hope that somehow we'll be able to keep some opportunities to drive cars in the future as well, that there's a certain space to do that. I really think that would be, is it important? No, but I just hope from a pleasure side and that it will be possible. But a concern that I also have, like, for example, is if there's like, I mean, I think the trucking space is maybe going to be one of the first spaces where we're going to see AI deployed in cars, because it's just one of the most benign environments. Yeah, so on the motorway from one depot to another without going into any city areas or anything. But isn't that, don't you see that as quite an issue? You're going to be on the motorway and you're just going to have these huge, massive, long convoys of artificial intelligence driven trucks without any drivers in there, and huge traffic as a result and all that. Do you see that as being an issue, or do you see there's definitely going to be progress as a result?
It's a tough question. The artificial intelligence part, I have no opinion on. I don't work in that area. But the whole business of electric trucks, I find impossible to grasp, because the mass, I mean, a truck in the United States is allowed to take up to 20 metric tons. How are you going to put a load of 20 metric tons on a truck unless it's all battery? I mean, it just, to me, there's a glibness there. I saw the demonstration of Musk driving up with an electric truck. Well, it was just the cab. There was no payload. Given what the energy density of batteries is now, and even doubling it, I just don't see how you're going to have an all-electric fleet. Your other point, I think, is the greater concern, which is the combination of some artificial intelligence-driven trucks with sentient motorists side by side. The truck on the highway is one thing, but that last mile, the truck, unless you're going to put all of your depots right there roadside on the highway, there's going to have to be some movement onto city streets. I'm still puzzled, but you know, maybe 20 years from now we'll look back on this and say it should have been obvious to us.
You say that a fully loaded truck, at the moment with where the batteries are at, you say you just cannot get the necessary range with a fully loaded truck. Is that what you're saying?
Yes. I mean, if you want to move, say, 10 tons of material, you probably have 10 tons of batteries.
Okay. And so that's not going to work.
Well,
so
what is the alternative? It can work if you're intent on it. I mean, I once saw an image of a hydrogen-powered car, and it was on the roads in Colorado. And the car is driving, and behind it is a giant tanker truck full of hydrogen, because there are no hydrogen fueling stations. But the whole idea is that petroleum, gasoline, has such a high energy density that in the confines of very few, several hundred liters, you can have an excellent range. But with batteries, that kind of scaling just doesn't happen. So I think people need to be a little bit more sanguine about some of these predictions.
So you're not taking Elon Musk too seriously at the moment when he shows the world his truck without any load in the back?
Well, if you just want to drive a truck that has no load, be my guest, but I don't see how that's going to change the trucking industry.
What other solution might you see which could enter into the trucking world sooner and be more sustainable?
Well, if you want to make it more sustainable, you could go with hydrogen right now.
Isn't sourcing hydrogen a disaster, though, for sustainability?
It is, but...
But you still think it can be okay?
That's a man-made problem. There's a man-made solution. If you have access to hydrogen filling stations, then you could, in principle, make transcontinental journeys.
So infrastructure.
Infrastructure, again. Exactly.
But that's not going to happen either, isn't it? Because everybody's focused on charging stations at the moment.
It's a question of whether the trucking industry says we're going to take matters into our own hands.
Okay, interesting.
Now, the other way to make something sustainable, I'm going to go way out on a limb, and that is to develop a device that destroys carbon dioxide as it's coming out of the tailpipe. And that way you can burn all of the hydrocarbon you want without contributing to greenhouse gas emissions. So if that would solve the problem, why aren't we working on the solution? The answer is because everybody says, well, of course, that can't be done. And I'm saying, no. It can be done if we make the investment in the research. Can you imagine a coal-fired power plant which does not emit carbon dioxide but gets thermal energy from the burning of coal? What would happen then? That would flip the whole debate, wouldn't it?
That's a big limb you're going on, though.
Yeah, well, I'll give you another big limb. So we'll have photovoltaic arrays all over the world. Now, at some point, it's dark here over the entire United States. Now, why can't I get electricity from where it's sunny in East Asia? And the answer is that the transmission lines are so long that the line losses are going to be insufferably high. Well, what about room temperature superconductivity? Then we could ship 12,000 kilometers with no loss. Well, that doesn't exist, but why isn't it? Why aren't we working on it? So I'm saying that you're going to have to be bolder in your imagination and then make the effort to make those solutions become a reality.
Maybe let's go a bit further forward then to 2050. Mm. Where do you see for my children and things like that and your children and grandchildren or whatever, how do you see the mobility space in 2050, so 30 years' time?
My guess is, if I had to make a prediction right now, all electric future, electricity generated sustainably, and the only place where you would see combustion would be in things like civilian aerospace. I can't imagine that you're going to get an Airbus 380 off the ground with batteries. We will burn some fuel.
Maybe with hydrogen?
When hydrogen is used, it's always used across a fuel cell. If you burn hydrogen in air, you don't make water. You make water and NOx, and the NOx is not good for the environment either. So you'd replace CO2 emissions with NOx emissions, and I don't think that would be too appealing. If we could have airplanes burning biofuel, I think that's a space that could be filled sensibly by those technologies. And then on the ground, all electric.
If I may, I'm going to take you a little bit out of the comfort zone again. And we're going to go into, because for e-mobility to make a big step towards sustainability globally, mm-hmm. We need, as you just said, the energy sources to become more and more renewable. Can you give us your insight and thoughts on where that's going to go, just big picture terms? Do you think solar is going to be the big one, or do you think it's solar and wind that are going to sort of stay on a level playing field and both grow together? How do you see that at the moment, and where is it going?
Well, solar is very big. It's scalable. I see wind is good, but I see pockets of resistance. The large turbines, they make noise, they hum, they're big and unsightly to some people. I mean, beauty is in the eye of the beholder, but some citizens object to the sighting of these large things.
You can put them 100 kilometers up in the sky.
Yeah, they'll fall back down to the ground. You can put them there, but they won't stay there. The spinning that keeps them there is going to negate all of the energy. How do we get the energy back down to the ground? So I think that, and then of course, if you want to go out of the comfort zone, there are two avenues, and they're being pursued at MIT and at spin-offs from MIT. And these are nuclear fission, but in a smaller reactor that doesn't generate nuclear waste, that the waste can actually be used as refuel. So it becomes a closed loop and scalable at a much lower size, because the cost of conventional nuclear power plants is in the billions of dollars. And so that nobody wants to make that commitment. If you could get the price down by a factor of 10 or 20, then it becomes a little bit more palatable. And then, of course, the one that would be most appealing would be fusion. And if we could get nuclear fusion to work, and there is a renewed effort at MIT on nuclear fusion, so now we're going to imitate the process in the sun in a reactor on the ground and generate electricity without the fear of radioactive waste. Those are long shots, but they're worth betting on, because if they succeed, they'll pay for all of the other stuff that we've spent money on with very little to show for it. So, Nico, if it's okay with you, maybe we can reverse the roles here, or maybe I'll ask you a question.
Oh, geez. I wasn't expecting this.
Well, you know, you had an illustrious career as a race car driver, and now you've moved on to the next phase of your professional activities. Where is your passion there right now? Clearly, you're interested in matters sustainable. Would you be able to say a few words about where your passion lies with this?
Okay, thank you. So I'm glad that the question isn't too difficult. this one will be fine to answer. No, so when I ended my racing career, what I learned in racing was really to focus 100% on just one thing. And I really believe in that for success, that it's a core ingredient of all successful people in our world. It's this ability to focus and to really commit to something. And so that's what I was doing in my career as well. So I had no real view on anything else that's going on. And when I stopped, what I did, and what I'm glad that I did, was really go out there, speak to people, and have a look at our whole world and what's out there and what's happening. And mobility really is going to play, mobility, which is close to home for me, is going to play such a huge role in this sustainability revolution that's now happening, and which is really going to go through the roof. And so suddenly, just naturally, I just got really fascinated. And mobility, I really started to explore more what's going on there. And so that's how I've gotten into this path. And it's an opportunity to have such a huge impact in our planet. And therefore, I want to get involved. Yeah, I want to get involved and be a part of this, and hopefully get all the way into some real depth and have a real part in something that's going to change all our lives. Yeah. And so initially now my path has been in the startup world as an investor as well. I think one of the coolest things that I got involved with for me has been Formula E, where I invested quite a long time ago, because I just believed in e-mobility, and Formula E is the pinnacle of e-mobility. Yeah. And this has gone really well, because it's really grown well. People are embracing it. It's awesome to see the forefront of e-mobility being battled out by all the car manufacturers on a racetrack. And fascinatingly, from a German perspective, in 1.5 years' time, in Formula E, there's going to be Mercedes against Audi, against BMW, against Porsche. Mm-hmm. This has never happened in the history of racing for Germany, that all the top manufacturers are going to be battling it out on a racetrack. This is so cool. So it's fascinating times. And this is the path that I'm currently taking in the startup world as well. And just really passionate about it and enjoying it. So this is why as well I'm sitting here today and have the pleasure of asking you questions with such great answers. And thank you so much for giving me and all of us, all of you listeners, such a great insight into your world, into what you're doing, and into how you're going to shape our future, yeah, with yourself and MIT in general. Professor Sadoway, thank you so much. It's really been a great pleasure. I appreciated it. Nice experience for me. First time to interview someone. Yeah, so I hope to meet again at some point in the future.
Thank you.
And our thanks to both Professor Donald Sadoway and, of course, to our very special guest host this week, Nico Rosberg. Thanks, too, are due to our friends behind the glass in the studios at CMD in New York. This has been a very special edition of The Bulletin with UBS here on Monocle 24. Listen again and find out more at monocle.com, or catch up wherever you get your podcasts. The Bulletin with UBS on Monocle 24.